Hello, and welcome to Mintcast, the podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. This is episode 227, recorded live on June 28th, 2015. I'm Scott, and with me on the podcast this week is Joe.
Hello.
Hey. We record live every other week on Sunday afternoons. Watch the Mintcast website or the Mintcast community on Google Plus for the schedule. The live stream information is at mintcast.org/livestream. And we're in the Mintcast channel on the SpotChat IRC server, irc.spotchat.org. And somebody might be over on the Freenode server, but it ain't me. So if you're on the Freenode server, come on over to the SpotChat server. Anyways. We've had just a little bit of pre-show music this week as I tried to get the streaming box up. It was Mind Things and Camera, the ones I usually play. So we'll have the Jamendo links to them. Go out and support them if you liked it. Anyways, Joe, you and I have not talked in just about forever. How you been?
Yeah, not too bad. Actually, not too bad. I hear you haven't been brilliant, but we'll probably get to that.
Yeah.
But what have I been doing in all this time? Well,
I know you had a big event. You probably talked about it a little bit, or maybe you didn't. But I know you had a big event, and saw the pictures. Looked like that went well.
Yeah, not too bad. But this week I've been a bit of a traitor, I'm afraid, to the Linux camp, in that someone came to me and said that they need a solution for viewing documents and drawings and things out in the wild, away from the office. And this person is not particularly computer literate. And so I thought, what is the best way to do that? So what would be your solution to that problem?
What specifically are they trying to do?
Trying to view documents and also drawings and, you know, schematics, that sort of thing, out in the wild.
It matters what kind of, if you're talking PDF, obviously you can do that anywhere, but if you're talking Visio.
No, I mean, you're talking PDFs, basically, just very basic stuff, just to be able to read information and also to be able to look things up on the web and stuff. The obvious solution to most people listening to this would be an Android tablet that you would tether to your phone's internet connection, probably, or possibly get a 3G one. But I'm afraid this person is so technologically illiterate that the only solution was an iPad.
Mm.
And so iPad Air 1, so the cheaper one with cellular, still £400, which is quite a lot of money, because they wanted it, he wants it big. He doesn't want it a small screen. He wants it as big as possible. And so I've been setting that up. Well, I say I've been setting it up. I pretty much just turned it on and it just worked. So I know that's kind of the stereotype. It just works. But I thought, right, let's see about opening some PDFs and some documents. And I thought I'd have to install loads of software and probably pay for it, but it just worked right out of the box. Just PDF, click to download, click to open, bang, opens up, no problem. Similarly with a docx, even just click to download, open up. And so I mean, I'd never have one for myself, but it is a lovely piece of hardware, and the software, for all its evilness, is actually very, very good. And it just makes me think that Android can learn an awful lot from iOS.
Yes.
I mean, you have got an iPhone, haven't you? So you kind of see both sides of the fence here.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think I've mentioned it before. My wife has an iPad. She has an iPad 2 or something. I don't know. And then my daughter has one of the original ones, which is a little clunkier. They are a really nice piece of hardware. And for what they do it pretty simply. And I like the model with the App Store as compared to the MacBook. The MacBook, I think I've talked about this before. There are text editors for the MacBook that are $40. There are password applications for the Mac that are $50. To me, that's absolutely ludicrous. But with the iPad, most of the apps, for the most part, are $1.99 to $4.99 or free. There's a bunch that are free as well.
Yeah.
And as you said, there's a lot of stuff that works out of the box. Now, as you mentioned, we're going to have a story a little later on, but with regards to Android, yes, you can do just about anything you want with it, but it seems like there's more work to it And maybe that's, again, to that thought that Apple makes a lot of default decisions for you and things work a certain way and they protect you from a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But they also, in protecting you, they prevent you from actually having access to a lot of stuff. But again, I think you're right. The only thing that I find restricting with, well, not the only thing, but one of the things I find restricting with the iPad is the actual size of the device. The when you're talking about viewing schematics or PDFs, or you know, I get a fair amount of quotes for hardware and things like that that I have to review. I can't deal with them on an iPad. They're just it's just too small of real estate, and I usually have to go to my laptop or to a an external monitor to try and view that stuff. Particularly schematics, I would imagine that would be a little tricky. Now, there's rumors afoot that they're coming out with an iPad Pro, which would be a larger device.
Yeah.
You know, more in the 10 or 11 or 12 inch style, which could be interesting, particularly when you compare it to something like a Surface Pro 3. So anyways, I think the idea of being a traitor to the cause, I think it's more a question of what's, Rob and I would always say, what's pragmatic? What yeah. makes sense in a particular case? And, you know, you want to give people the right tools to do the jobs they want to do. And I'll talk a little bit more about this in just a minute. And so I think that, recommending to somebody to get an iPad isn't necessarily the wrong idea.
No, I mean, if someone comes to me and says, what would you buy yourself? Then I'd say, well, I'd a Nexus 10 or mm-hmm. a Nexus 9 if I want something. But the question is, you're not trying to solve your own problem. You're trying to solve someone else's problem. And if yep. that solution happens to be Apple-based and they can afford it, then that's the way to go, because, time is money, and this is a business device. And, I did think about the possibility of the Microsoft way of doing things, but just the iPad is so simple that it just seemed like the right solution, and time will tell whether that actually proves to be the right solution, but you never know.
Yeah, we've certainly seen cases, everybody harkens back to the original cheap machines and such that were running Linux that got sold out of Walmart, that got returned, and the netbooks and such, because it was not the right solution for a lot of people. And, you don't want to set somebody up with a Linux box or an Android machine that's not going to solve their issues. That's going to turn them off even further to the idea that they can use anything but a Windows-based machine. Or in an Apple-based machine. It's just, so again, it's what's the right solution for the problem people are trying to solve.
Yeah. And quickly before we move on, I've also started listening to The Martian, the audiobook of The Martian, which is a movie that's coming out, I think, this summer, and about an astronaut who gets stranded, left for dead, assumed dead, on Mars, and has to grow his own food and solve problems. And I'm only a couple of chapters in, and it's absolutely brilliant. So,
Matt Damon's going to be in that movie.
Matt Damon, yes, he's going to be in it. So, yep. Look out for that if you're into science fiction books.
Awesome. So we were talking a little bit about it in the pre-show, but I've had sort of a crazy adventure over the last month or so. I, as you guys were aware, I wasn't on the last episode. I was traveling, and I ended up traveling for work up to New Jersey, and then I went down to Florida in part to help out my mom, who was coming off some surgery. Well, just a couple of days after I got her out of the hospital, I ended up in the ER myself. I ended up having a kidney stone, which I don't wish on anybody. This is an incredibly painful experience that this tiny 2 millimeter little stone can feel so uncomfortable as it makes its travel, its incredible journey through your body, and eventually, hopefully, and it has yet to happen, passes out and you get rid of it. So I'm waiting for that. But I was, like I say, I ended up in the ER, and that I lost a couple of days in there in a painkiller induced haze trying to get on the other side of that. But while I was down there, in fact, unfortunately, on the last day I was there, my mom asked me to do some stuff on her computer. And you guys may recall, I set my mom up with Linux Mint 13, the LTS with XFCE desktop some time ago. And so she just wanted her printer ink swapped out, but you can't do it. I think it's a Brother printer or something. And it comes with a Windows-based application where you can actually change out the ink so that the ink cartridges move to the right place inside the printer itself, so you can actually get to them and swap out the ink. Well, there's a few manual commands that you have to do in a particular order so you can make it work under Linux. And I actually was able to do that. But in the meantime, her computer started throwing some errors and wouldn't shut down properly. So eventually we ended up having to punch the box to get it to go down, and then it wouldn't come back up. I was getting kicked into an emergency grub command prompt on the way back up. And so I was like, oh, this should be easy. This just grub got screwed up somehow on the hard reboot, and I should be able to figure this out. And so I took a live CD and booted into that, and could not access the hard drive. It would not mount the hard drive. And so I started Googling around, trying to figure stuff out. I ended up running EFSCK, which is a disk checker on the disk level. So it's not, you know, it's down at the hard disk level, and it started, could not read a ton of the disk, which basically what happened is her disk failed. And it was down hard. I can't get anything off of it. My mom doesn't have much on that computer, so there's not, we didn't lose very much, but we can't use the computer anymore. So unfortunately, I had another computer that I had given her, but my nephew had absconded with it when he had visited, and now that's somewhere else in the country as well. So I'm in the process of building out a computer for my mom to send down there. I have a laptop here that I'm going to send down, but it was just an unfortunate problem to have and have it happen on the very last day. So my poor mom's been incommunicado as far as computers go for the last week, which I imagine for her, it's not nearly as devastating as it would be for myself, or probably for just about anybody listening to this to this podcast. I recall last year we went up to Virginia to where my aunt lives, and they're way back in the woods. And I might have talked about this on the podcast, but they have no cell signal up there, and there's no internet. And my aunt, actually, at their house, they have internet because they brought it in via cable from across the mountain and with the DSL line. But she doesn't have wireless at her house. So the whole time we were up there, we had absolutely no, we had a little bit of cable TV, but we had nothing else and couldn't get any internet at all. And it was devastating with no internet and no cellular, not being prepared for it. We're planning on going back up. And when we do, we'll know what we're getting ourselves into. But when you get into a situation where you are totally cut off from the kind of communication that we take for granted now, it can be devastating. Fortunately for my mom, it's not like that. So anyways, I'm building out a machine right now. We'll talk about that more when we talk about the main topic. But it's just unfortunate that the machine she had is funny, because I ran when I used the Linux Mint 13 live CD to actually boot into the box and to get a look at it. And I ran INXI on that, and it turned out she's got a Pentium 4.
Ooh, nice.
This machine, yeah, Pentium 4 with an 80 gig hard drive. So it's probably about an 8 or 9 year old machine, maybe even older. So
I'd say
so
older, probably. Yeah, that sounds like having an IDE hard drive, probably.
It probably did. You're probably right. So I think it put in its time. So I'm not so so upset that I'm getting her a new machine. So, anyways, so that's some of what I've been up to. It's been fun to be playing with this stuff. And to be, you know, to have a real purpose for it. So I'm glad to be able to do that. I'm glad, you know, it just reminds me of how great Linux is, that you can take a machine and you have this operating system that's free and readily available and is really polished at this point, is so easy to install and to make a fully functioning machine versus trying to install Windows or anything else on it. So again, it was just sort of reminded me of how much I love Linux and love using it. So anyways. Mm. What we're going to end up talking about later in the podcast is Peppermint 6. We mentioned it before. We got some feedback from some of the folks on the Peppermint team last week, our last podcast, and we decided to take a closer look at it. So we're going to be talking about Peppermint 6. But before we do that, we are actually going to take a look at a little bit of news. So our first news story actually comes from the Linux Mint blog, and that is that Linux Mint 17.2 Rafaela, Cinnamon, and Mate RCs have been released. So this means that typically what we've seen lately is these RCs have been pretty polished, and we should be seeing the final version in not too long. So Joe, have you actually gotten a chance to look at these yet?
I had a very quick look today, and to be honest, I couldn't see anything hugely different, really. I didn't dig deeply into the version numbers of things, but it all seemed to be much the same, really. The new Cinnamon, which I'd already tried out on 17.1, but apart from that, it just seems to be incremental improvements, really. Just stability and speed improvements, and nothing big and flashy. The basically the kind of release that I like. So yeah, all good so far.
Yeah, I think we've talked about the fact that what we thought we would see from the Mint team under the new regime, where they're based on the LTS, and is the ability to dig deeper into things like Cinnamon, some of the the MDM logon manager, a bunch of other things. One of the things that was nice is under LibreOffice, they actually upgraded it to the 4.4.3 version. So we've seen that. There was always the question of how they were going to, be able to keep stuff up to date. And I mean, I know that's not the be all and end all, but at the very least, we're seeing some upgrades there with these dot releases in the 17 series. There, if you go into the some of the stuff about what's new, there is quite a bit of stuff that they have done, but a lot of it has been, again, with the Mint-based tools, some of the tools that they've written. They've done some improvements in system settings. They've done some improvements with MDM. They brought back an actual screensaver, we didn't have screensavers, so there is screensavers now. Obviously the improvements in Cinnamon 2.6 itself that, as you said, we've talked about and have been out there for a little bit of time now. But there's a fair amount of stuff under the hood that they've done. They've also done some stuff inside of Nemo. Nemo's seen some improvements. Software sources have seen some improvements. They're actually allowing you to get deeper into, you can dig into PPAs and actually look at, you can look at a PPA and look at all the packages that the PPA offers. So if you want to back rev, if you're doing like on the line or something, and you want to back rev, you can do that. They're actually allowing you to see foreign packages, so you can downgrade in those. So there's a bunch of stuff there that's actually pretty cool and is really more in the Mint tools versus the stuff that the base distro and things along those lines. I know we got some feedback last week with regards to wallpapers, and somebody was sort of complaining that that there weren't new wallpapers in it with Cinnamon 2.6. But obviously, wallpapers are more part of a distro release than they are a desktop environment. Mm. And there is a bunch of artwork that's coming with 17.2. They'll have a bunch of new artwork, but plus they give you access to all the artwork going back to Maya. So 5-6 versions back. So and we've talked about the fact I really like some of the wallpapers that they've been starting to include. In fact, when you talk about Peppermint a bit, this is a place where the Peppermint could improve in adding additional access to wallpapers. But we'll talk about that more later. So, anyways, I think it'll be interesting to see. As you guys are aware, we don't review RCs. We just take a quick look at them. I did the download. I haven't installed it yet, and I will actually try an incremental upgrade as well because of the fact that this is 17.2 and is supposed to allow for that. So we'll see. We'll see how that works. And in an upcoming episode, we'll be talking about Linux Mint 17.2.
Okay, so moving away from the Linux Mint news, then to the more general Linux news. And the story that just keeps on coming back, and that is Jonathan Riddle. And this time he has resigned from the Kubuntu Community Council. Now, we haven't really spoken about this, Scott. I don't think we've spoken since this whole thing happened.
No.
And just a quick recap, I suppose. The Ubuntu Community Council asked Jonathan to step down from his leadership role in the Kubuntu Community Council. He said he wasn't a leader. They're all equal. Even though he is more equal than others, or was, given that he started the project. There was a lot of mudslinging, a lot of bad blood. It was all pretty much about the fact that he'd asked some awkward questions of Canonical, and they had, well, or yeah, at least of Ubuntu, the whole project. And then the community council had said that he'd asked them in the wrong way and he'd been behaving badly. And he was adamant that he was not going to step down because they had an election where he was re-elected as a member of the Kubuntu Community Council. And then everything went a bit quiet and we didn't really hear much. There was a little bit of chatter on the mailing lists and there was talk of a proper meeting about it. And now this has come out that he's resigned. He has backed down, which I did not see coming, to be honest. I thought that I didn't know how this stalemate was going to end. And so it seems that he has now backed down. He's resigned from the community council. He's going to continue as a developer, one would imagine, probably the lead developer on Kubuntu. And so the release, the 15.10 release, which is coming in a few months, is back on track. The Alpha 1, they are participating in. Not all the flavors are. I know Ubuntu Mate are another flavor who are participating in this Alpha 1. And so it seems to be all hunky-dory, as we would say in the UK, except for the article on Pharonix that you put in here, Scott.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Which says that in the release notes, it said at the top of them, the Kubuntu team are committed to releasing 15.10 in October. Updates, bug fixes, and future releases are currently uncertain. But if you look at the release notes, that has disappeared. And I had a quick look through the wiki and you can see the revisions and it doesn't seem to be in any of those revisions. So unless someone on high has deleted it, I don't really know what's going on there, but that certainly does cast a bit of a shadow over the whole thing. It seemed to be solved, but perhaps it isn't.
Yeah. So, you know, first off, you wonder, what brought them to the point where they decided that Jonathan would resign from the Kubuntu Council? So something happened. They talk about one of the articles that we'll link to talks about a meeting between Jonathan and Shuttleworth and somebody else where this was what they decided. So was there a payoff? Was there threats? Was there, based on the sort of the hard positions that the different parties had taken, as you said, the Canonical position was this guy needs to step down. And the Ubuntu Community Council position was he needs to step down. The Jonathan's position and his supporters, which included the Kubuntu Community Council, was that he's not stepping down. And if we're going to move forward, we're going to move forward with Jonathan. Well, something changed, as you said, to arrive at this solution. And I don't, we're not hearing what that is yet. And that's probably out there. And typically these things come out at some point. But something happened to bring us to that position. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when I spoke to Jonathan in the middle of the night over a 3G connection, which was fun, I really got the impression from him that he was definitely not going to back down on this and that he had the full support of the Kubuntu Council. And that, he was being very bullish about that and saying that, very much implying that it was the end of the road, really, that either Canonical were going to back down or that was it. And I said to him, so, what happens in that situation? Would you do, would you rebrand? Would you essentially fork it and, take out the Ubuntu branding? And he said, well, no, because there are other KDE-based Ubuntu derivatives and we don't want to be another one of those. And he talked about possibly working with Debian, and it seemed like this was just not going to be the outcome. So I was very surprised when this was the outcome. And as you say, this stuff has gone on behind the scenes that it would be very interesting to learn about what exactly happened here.
Yeah. And then, the other thing to recognize is the second article that we linked to from Pharonix. Pharonix, obviously, all the content on Pharonix is generated by Michael Larrabel. And Michael does a great job. He's been on the open source scene for a long time. And it really is not a rumor monger. You know, this isn't TMZ or anything like that. The article, he did write it. So he found that in the release notes, and that was sort of his speculation as to, it does this mean that 15.10 is going to be the last Kubuntu that we see? And maybe, you know, maybe that was the original response. You know, you have to imagine that everybody can't be satisfied with this solution, this outcome. There have to be people took hard stands, people on the Kubuntu Council. And so with Jonathan stepping down, there have to be people who are not satisfied with the outcome. And so it's going to be interesting to see. Obviously, we'll keep following it. You know, personally, I'm not a Kubuntu user, so this doesn't really affect me directly. But it is a very well put together release. And, you know, you hate to see stuff like this happen. I don't know. We'll just keep our eye on it, I guess, from here going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of all ties into how Ubuntu is moving away from being a community to being its own thing. You know, when it started with the buttons, and then instead of Wayland, going to Mir, and now going to Snappy. You know, it seems like they're getting ready to dump the community. At least I've heard chatter about that. That is the feeling amongst the community, that it's getting ready to, you know, Canonical's getting ready to just dump it all and just be a proper commercial Red Hat type company. So it remains to be seen, and it wouldn't be at all surprising. But then again, it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that Shuttleworth wants to do. But he's a very unpredictable man.
It seems as though Canonical is moving from black eye to black eye. They just don't. They struggle to make positive moves in the open source community. I think they're really struggling to engender trust. I think they've burned a tremendous amount of credibility and trust in the community, and they struggle to make proper moves. Everything they do now is seems to be viewed with a, you know, sort of a jaundiced eye, that just people don't trust what they're doing. I've argued before that Ubuntu is not a community-based distribution in any way, shape, or form. So,
yeah.
Anyways, enough piling on the Canonical folks. In an interesting piece of news, and you know, I almost wasn't going to include this because we don't necessarily talk about Android a whole lot. We don't talk about phones a whole lot. We avoid the subject for the most part. But news came out just the other day, a couple days ago, that now you can actually get full-blown Microsoft Office for your Android phone or tablet. And I think this is a big deal. Microsoft actually made available Excel, Word, and PowerPoint for the Android platform. And they're actually working with major Android manufacturers to preload these applications on devices that'll be on the market in the fall. So, you know, you send your buddy. Now when the question, you know, somebody comes to you and they say they want to view this, or this, it might make that the answer a little more difficult. It isn't necessarily an iPad. Now you can get, for some time now, maybe about 6 months, you've been able to get full-blown Microsoft applications on iPad, on iOS. Now you can get them on Android. And because of the variety of devices that you can get on the Android platform, you know, that same question could be answered with a larger Android device, depending on, you know, what somebody's needs were. So I think this, there's a couple things that I read into this. One is that Microsoft is getting smarter about making their stuff available and keeping people dependent, you know, keeping people hooked into Microsoft Office, because so many people, because of the rise of mobile computing, because of the rise of these devices, I think a tremendous amount of people looked at alternatives. The Apple alternatives that they offer, Pages, and they have a couple other things that, you know, are so-so. Google Docs, you know, things along those lines, using Dropbox to move around just, you know, rich text format or even just straight up text documents. And so I think with Microsoft making their applications available for more and more platforms, I think they have to do this. And so it's amazing that it's taken them this long to get here. Two, I think it's great that from their point of view that they're doing this, and that people who are hooked into these formats can get these applications on an Android device, on an iOS device. The interesting thing is these applications, I know on the iOS side, they're huge.
I was going to say that 100 megabytes for Word on Android.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's probably pretty small, actually.
Well, compared to on Windows, it's pretty small. Yeah.
Yeah. But I would imagine Excel and PowerPoint are probably larger to get on there.
Mm.
But, you know, again, it just gives you the opportunity. And, you know, I couldn't tell from the, we'll link to an office.com, which is Microsoft. We're going to link to their press release for this. And the reason I went to that one, the story's out in a number of different places, but I wanted to get, you know, basically from the horse's mouth. So we're going to link back to Office. But I couldn't tell in there, do you need an Office 365 subscription to use these?
You have to sign in to be able to save or edit. And I didn't get that far. So I'm not sure whether that actually means you have to pay or not, or whether you can use them. I don't know. That's a good, I wish I'd signed in now. I wish I'd created an account and seen if you can do it for free, because that would make sense, wouldn't it? But you can certainly view documents at least. But
that's, yeah, and we know, yeah, Microsoft's been really trying to drive people to this subscription model versus buying software. So the Office 365 is really where they're trying to take people. You know, we want $100 a year, every year in and year out for,
yeah, well, that's, you know, for, that's a new model, isn't it? That's what Adobe have been doing with their
Creative Suite. Yeah, it's Adobe too, exactly. And so this would make sense that this was an extension of that versus allowing you to, and it may be, I think the way it works on iOS is you can view, and I don't know if you can edit, and you certainly can't save back to like a SkyDrive or anything without a 365 account. I think that's how it works there. So again, but I think, you know, I think this is a positive thing for Android. This is sort of Microsoft making their stuff available for a Linux-based platform.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really... There's two ways to look at this. Are Microsoft shooting themselves in the foot in terms of there's now almost no reason to buy a Surface or a Windows 10-based mobile device, because you can just buy an Android device and use the same applications? So are they doing themselves out of that, or are they tapping into the billions of people who have got Android devices already? You know, so it depends which way you look at it. They must have done the maths on it and have worked out that it is better to make it available for Android and iOS and just sort of almost admit that their mobile platform is a failure.
Yeah, although they supposedly, and based on a story we covered, I don't know, several episodes back, their hardware division is actually doing well. And the Surface is what's driving that.
What, not Xbox? I would have thought Xbox is driving it.
I can't
it.
Remember if they broke those out. They do some weird stuff with their accounting and how their accounting's set up and how they break out their different divisions. But the Surface is actually a success story for Microsoft.
Oh, right. I suppose because they're so expensive, they only have to sell a few of them.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. All right, well, back to some more open source news, or should we say proprietary news, and that was about Chromium. Now, it must have been a few weeks ago, I think, that this story broke, that it turns out that Chromium was downloading this binary, which is effectively a spying binary, because anyone with an Android phone must be aware, at least, of OK Google, which is, it's constantly listening, and you say, OK Google, search for Chinese takeaways, and it just does it for you. I obviously turn that off, being somewhat privacy conscious, and use a different launcher. But the idea is to bake this into Chrome in the near future. And for some reason, this slipped past the maintainers of Debian. And it's ended up being that if you've got Chromium installed, it will automatically download this proprietary binary. And supposedly, it isn't turned on by default. You have to go into the settings and switch it on. But it's proprietary, so we don't know that for sure, do we? We have to trust Google. Well, now it has been ripped out, but it's still in Chrome. And again, not activated by default, but if it is turned on, then it is essentially listening to you all the time. And the question is how much of that is being sent back to their servers and how much of it is just stored locally. And because it's proprietary, as we keep coming back to, there is no way to know that. So it's really put me off Chromium. I was considering the switch. I've been talking about it for ages, about how I'm really just sick of how slow Firefox is getting. And, you know, I was thinking about moving over to Chromium, but this is really, it's really made me think twice about that. And I'll touch on it briefly in the main topic as well. So I just now, I mean, I know that it's gone now and it's not really a problem anymore, but if it can happen once, maybe it could happen again. It's probably less likely, but still it's, it just leaves a nasty taste in the mouth.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a couple ways to look at this, and that is absolutely one way you can, you know, you can approach this and think about it. The other is that in fact, Google responded to the open source community when they came and said, hey, you can't have this proprietary stuff in an open source browser. And so you can give them credit for saying, yeah, you're right. We should take that out of there. Not only that, the next time, if anybody did in fact download it, the next time Chromium upgrades, which happens all the time,
yeah,
that upgrade will strip it out if in fact it's on your machine. So, I mean, that's one way of looking at it, saying, okay, yeah, this is a positive thing that Google is in fact keeping Chromium as an open source browser, and, you know, honoring the wishes of the open source community. It does, on the other hand, make you raise concern for me with regards to Chrome. The fact that this will automatically be there in Chrome. I think I run Chrome on the MacBook, and I think I might go find Chromium and see if I can get that on there and strip Chrome back out, because this is, you know, so it's called the hotshot keyword or something like this module. And as you said, it's to fulfill the desire that Google has to allow people to say, okay, Google, you know, like you say, give me all the numbers for Chinese takeaway. You know, and we've all seen the OK Google commercials, you know, OK Google, how far is the moon from Earth, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, to that end, that's some people would see that, oh, that's a great little feature. It's like Siri or, you know, or the Amazon Echo, which I don't know if I've talked much about my Amazon Echo, but we have one of those and it's an interesting little device. But this idea, as you said, it is always listening. And it's always buffering in case you say, okay, Google. And according to Google, you know, and you probably saw this in the article as well, it only buffers locally. None of that's supposed to go back to Google search servers until you say, okay, Google. And then it sends whatever you say next back to their search engine in, you know, somewhere in Southern California or wherever. Well, any device, I mean, I worry about this with my Amazon Echo. You know, my wife and I are always talking about, you know, is this thing listening to us all the time? You know, you watch any shows like Person of Interest, or, you know, you follow the NSA leaks that are coming out. You know, they just dumped some more documents from Snowden that, you know, just the level of privacy invasion that has gone on, particularly in the States, but in the UK as well. In the last 10 years is just amazing, that in fact, you know, we sort of stood by and said, this is all fine. And so something like this, as you said, it makes you very nervous in terms of what, you know, what their intentions are. It's almost like you want to find out, you know, what port does this go out on and block that port.
Yeah.
You know, if it's just going out as a regular HTTP call, then, you know, you can't block port 80 or you're not going to be able to use the internet anymore, at least through a browser, or 443 or anything like that. But yeah, definitely there's, you know, this, it's interesting that they're making this move at this particular time when there's so much concern around privacy, and people's awareness of it has been raised quite a bit. I have a lot invested in the Google sort of environment, Gmail. You know, we're actually using Google Docs for the show notes for the show as we speak. And I are both looking at the same Google Doc. You know, these types of things. But it does. You're absolutely right. When you talk about the privacy concerns and how it makes you think, I'd like to think that Chromium is safe now, that people are going to be keeping a closer eye, people in the open source community, on this, but who knows?
Yeah, you'd hope so. But going back to your point of that, being grateful for Google to having ripped it out and sorted it out again. Well, I mean, that's a little bit like someone punches you in the face and then you're grateful for them driving you to the ER to get stitches. you know,
well, they could leave you on the curb bleeding.
Well, yeah, but you know, they still punched you in the face, didn't they? So I'm not having it, really, that argument. You know, they shouldn't have done it in the first place, and promising to not do it again, it just doesn't really feel enough to me. And the thing is, this hasn't really generated as much of a buzz as I thought it would.
Yeah.
There's not been anything on mainstream news at all. I mean, I suppose you wouldn't really expect that. But, you know, it's drawn attention to the fact that, as you say, in Chrome, it's there. It's potentially always listening. And then again, though, you talk about the NSA and you implied, I think, that although it's supposed to not be sending data back to Google, if the NSA or another government agency wanted to make them, you know, wanted to give them the order, they would probably be able to turn that on. But to be fair, all of our devices run some proprietary software, be it in the binary, in the BIOS, sorry, or in the firmware for the hard drive or SSD. So or in phones, obviously, there's loads of proprietary software as well. So they've got that capability already, and this is just going to make it that little bit easier for them.
Yep.
Which actually leads, strangely, into the next story. In that... Oh,
I was going to say, are you reading that story or am I reading that story?
Well, you do it, and then I'll tell you why it leads in.
Yeah, I kept trying to tee it up for you, and I was wondering why you didn't start into it. So our last story in the news docket, as Joe says, is directly related to that prior story, and that's that DuckDuckGo, the DuckDuckGo search engine that you may have encountered in versions of Mint, actually surpassed 10 million daily queries for the first time on June 22nd. So the company gives credit to the surge in users being based on the fact that people are privacy focused and they want a privacy focused search engine. And they said, Gabriel Weinberg, who's at DuckDuckGo, says, quote, "We're proud to be helping so many people take back their privacy." So the reason why I wanted to include this story is one that the first time I encountered DuckDuckGo was when Mint entered into some sort of agreement with them and made it the default search engine in I can't remember which version of Mint, but it's probably at least two or three or four versions ago. To be honest, I would change it to Google, the default search engine.
Yep.
That's just me. To see that they're gaining in popularity like this is great. DuckDuckGo does not retain any information about your searches, does not use it in any fashion, form or fashion like Google does to sell you stuff, to direct your ads. In fact, it would be a good exercise. So I actually clicked on something recently. It was a vertical docking station for a Mac. And now every single page that I go to that has those plug-in ads is showing me that same vertical docking station. And you guys are all aware of this. You go to Home Depot and you search for grills, charcoal grills, and you're going to see ads for that for the next week and a half, whether you buy one or not. And part of that is some of the searches that you do through Google, they'll track you and they'll sell you stuff. Well, DuckDuckGo doesn't do that. So, you know, I wanted to include the story, one, because we first place I saw this was in Mint, and two, that I think this is a great idea, and I'm really happy that they're seeing some success. Now, to spoil the party, Joe put in an extra line after I put the news story in. And just for context, Google's daily figure is somewhere north of 3 billion searches.
It could be as much as 4 billion by now, because they've been a bit cagey about it since about 2012, when it was at 3.3 billion. And recently they've said that it hasn't gone down. So it could, who knows, it could be 5 billion. It could be more than that. Because, you know, now with Android taking off, every time you search for something on Android, that's a Google search as well, isn't it? So, yeah. And I mean, color me cynical for a change, but DuckDuckGo, everybody raves about it because they make all these promises about privacy and security. And you may anecdotally see that, yeah, you don't get adverts for grills after you've been searching for one. So there is that obvious benefit to using DuckDuckGo. But I think that it's somewhat naive to think that they are necessarily keeping the promises that they're very vocal about. Because the fact remains that they are a commercial company in the United States. They are DuckDuckGo Inc. And that means that they are subject to the same government interference as any other company, and court orders, and all of the slightly shadier NSA stuff. So there is no reason why a government agency couldn't go into DuckDuckGo, give them a gagging order to say they can't talk about it, and then mine as much data about as many people as they want. Meanwhile, the kind of people who are probably going to go to this are going to be specific targets. The kind of people who want to hide their online searches, obviously there'll be, of those 10 million searches, most of them won't be by someone doing anything wrong. But if I was a government agency, that's probably one of the first places I'd go to try and find people who are doing something wrong. So it may be cynical and it might be spoiling the party, but for me, it's a very important thing to think about, that it's all well and good to have this illusion of privacy and security, but if it's not backed up by fact, then there's, you know, it's just a false sense of security, I think.
Ah, Joe.
I don't know. Am I way off base here, or, you know?
No, you raise a good point. You know, we know that we've taken for granted these things in the past, and that was one of, you know, there's those who view Edward Snowden as a traitor, there's those who view him as a whistleblower, but you can't argue the fact that he shined a very bright light on a bunch of activities that people would have said weren't happening. And so the scenario under which you just, you know, described, where the government could be accessing the search histories out of DuckDuckGo, it's a very realistic scenario. So, you know, there's no counter to that. But, you know, I guess I want to be naive and think that, you know, maybe they're the little engine that could, and they, you know, their model is such that they don't, you know, they don't even retain this information. So they can't, you know, it's not there to access in the first place. I don't know. But, you know, that all being said, I don't use DuckDuckGo. I still use Chrome.
Well, I had to use it a little bit for the main topic because I didn't get around to changing it. And don't care for it. Google's just easier and better.
So. Yeah, that's been my experience. And maybe if I spent more time with it. But it's good to see that they're having success. And if you look at if you click in through the article, and I know you did, and you see the graph, they graph their traffic. And basically, they exploded since November of last year.
Hockey stick style, yeah.
Yeah. And it'd be interesting to know, you know, to dig into some of the reasons why that actually went. Well, you know, did they show up in more places? What drove that that sort of explosion of daily searches? So anyways, we'll have the link in the show notes if you guys want to go out there and take a look.
To end it on a positive note, at least it shows people are interested. If they're not necessarily going about it the right way and they're being naive about it, there is a demand for this stuff. And so hopefully someone will find a way to make a distributed kind of peer-to-peer search-based system that is truly anonymized and genuinely takes care of your privacy.
There you go. Way to end on a positive note. All right, so that is going to do it for the news. We're going to hop into the main topic, where we're going to be talking about Peppermint 6. So outside of a few quick hits, we have not reviewed Peppermint in years. And, you know, Peppermint has a sort of kinship with Mint, Linux Mint itself. Kendall, who was involved in the early, the mid Mint releases, you guys may recall the first review that we did as a group, this would have been myself and Rob and others, in episode 52, was a review of Fluxbox, and we interviewed Kendall on the show at that point in time. And I got to know some of the other guys on the Peppermint team, particularly a gentleman named Shane Remington, who's based out of Asheville, North Carolina, not too far away from me here. Actually, they would slip me early versions. I think Peppermint 2, I actually found a conversation I had with Shane back in 2011 with regards to Peppermint 2, and he slipped me a beta version of that before they went public with it. So there's sort of, like I say, there's been this kinship with Mint, but we haven't really talked about Peppermint, and we haven't reviewed it in years. Now, they just released Peppermint OS 6, which also marks their fifth anniversary in the open source world. And so we thought, as you guys know, we had some feedback. We mentioned a few shows ago, we had some feedback from somebody on the Peppermint OS team, and had that in the feedback from last week. But we decided to take a closer look, Joe and I, and went about installing it, and have some different impressions and wanted to pass it on to you. So, Joe, I'm going to let you start, and then I will hop in as we go.
Okay, well, let me give it a spoiler at the beginning. I really, really like Peppermint, and I'm going to be really positive about it almost universally. So this is a real stop press moment, me actually not being negative about something. And it, just from the very beginning of the experience, you go to the website and it's just so clear and easy to navigate, download, select which one you want. Do you want torrent or direct? And just instantly you're left with a good impression of it, aren't you? You're hit with a good yes. impression of it. It feels like a clean, well-designed website by people who know what they're doing.
Yep.
That said,
let me just agree with you on a couple of things. One, very positive about it. And that you're absolutely right. You, from the very start, you get that, it's very clear what's going on. The website doesn't have a bunch of extraneous junk going on. You don't get, there's not tons of banner ads or things along these lines. And it's very clean, very crisp, and very clear we'll talk about that more, but that translates through and perpetuates through the entire experience.
Yeah. Our friend Gary Newell over on Everyday Linux User wrote an article in the last couple of weeks talking about Debian and how it just all goes wrong before you even install it because of the terrible website and the myriad choices of different architectures and stuff, whereas this is just really straightforward. So, yeah, that's a very positive start. The a bit of a negative stumble is that I had that same issue on my C720 Chromebook that I had with Mint, and it says, when you try and boot it, it says, not enough memory to load specified image. Now, that is, I can only assume it's checking, the part of the boot process checks how much RAM you've got, and if you haven't got enough, then it won't do it. So it must be returning the wrong value somehow. And I don't have that problem with other distros. There is a website called DistroShare, which does specific versions of distros with specific support for certain Chromebooks and certain machines, like my one, the C720. But unfortunately, there's no image on there. So I had to chuck it on other hardware because the Chromebook's become my test hardware, my mm-hmm. go-to, because it's so portable and light and quick with the SSD and everything. So I had to chuck it on my other older Vio, but I had no problems with there at all. And, you know, one thing that strikes me about Peppermint is that they're not afraid to use other people's software and to take advantage of the fact that it's free open source software and you can use it. It's based, well, this is something that Andy Mitchell, who's part of the Peppermint team, I think he's more in the advocacy role. He posted that Peppermint 6 is loosely based on Lubuntu and is built upon Ubuntu 14.04.2 LTS. The desktop is a highly customized version of LXDE that uses the XFWM4 instead of OpenBox as its window manager. This produces a refined desktop with effects such as transparencies and rounded corners without compromising on lightness. And so, yeah, it's standing on the shoulders of giants, basically.
Yep.
And so you've got your Ubiquiti installer. And I always say when I review a distro that doesn't have it, I say, well, why not? It's free open source software, use it. And they've not tried to go out of their way, Peppermint, to do things to stand out somehow. And, you know, if there is an existing tool that is good at its job, then they'll just use it. And that is a very positive way of doing things. Rather than doing the canonical way and write our own one, why waste the resources on that?
Exactly. And you know, we've got some feedback. It's interesting. We have some feedback a little later, and we'll get to that around the Ubiquiti installer. But in this particular case, particularly since you're based on the core of Peppermint OS 6, is 1404. and the LTS.
Yeah.
And so from that point of view, it's going to be supported out till 2019, which is awesome. But because you're based on that, why not take advantage of the positive things in there and start with that as a core? And Ubiquity would be one of those because it's so dead simple.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. But so once you boot into the desktop, be it live or having installed it, it looks good, doesn't it? I mean, it doesn't. It's a little bit basic, and it's not incredibly flashy, but it looks good enough for me. The wallpaper's a bit strange, but you know, it's all easy to change, and it looks it. You hit, the first impression of it is good. I think it looks professional and well put together.
It's that clean. It's got a clean, crisp look. It's like you say, it's a little Spartan, and I would have liked, you know, the wallpapers are all in a particular theme. You know, they give you, basically they've made one wallpaper for Peppermint 6. They give you the option of putting probably the default wallpaper from Peppermint 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And most of them are dark. They have two or three light ones. They could have, at the very least, they should make it easy, you know, even like a get more, and they take out a DeviantArt or something. You know, I want to change, like, I'm building, I'll spill the beans now, but I'm building for my mother is I'm going to use Peppermint, and we'll talk more about why in just a minute. But I want to change the wallpaper. I don't think my mom would like the you know, honeycomb techno art.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to put a beach scene or a sunset or something like that on there. I'm going to have to go do this manually. Now, as we know, this is not that hard. You know, search DuckDuckGo or Google for, you know, sunset wallpapers. And I'll probably get a bunch of, you know, garbage and emoticon, you know, stuff that would auto install on a Windows box, but I'll be able to find the stuff and I'll be able to put it in there. But that's probably, and these are niggling complaints. These are very small, you know, issues. But that would definitely be one of them. I think they should have a greater wallpaper, collection to choose from.
Well, I think part of that is also fits in with the software selection, and it all feels very stripped down, doesn't it? And
yes, it does.
It fits on a CD, which is important for older hardware.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm going to do it via USB, so it doesn't really matter whether it's 700 megs or 2 gigs or whatever. I've got enough bandwidth. But
that's unusual. That's unusual to find a mainstream distro that fits on a CD.
It is these days, yeah.
So. Yeah. Give him credit for that.
Yeah, but I mean, that's part of that is why there's not really much software. There's no Office Suite, for example. I mean, we'll get to the web apps in a second. But, you know, there seems to be a sensible set of default applications, though. You know, rather than having an audio player and a video player, they just use VLC. And that's what Ubuntu Mate has started doing as well. And that, to me, is a very... It's not a Unixy way of doing things. Obviously, that's one tool for each job. Whereas this is a sort of jack of all trades tool that is generally pretty good, and it's the first thing I always install. So
yeah, I was going to say VLC has proven its worth over and over again, and has been a great application for a long time now. And so it's great to see distros starting to include it, particularly this one, which it's almost an anomaly on this because of its ability to do multiple things, that it is a mainstream application when you look at what else is included software wise. But it's a positive one in my mind.
Yeah. And it's also got Pulse Audio VU control, which most people probably never have to deal with because you've just got one machine. But if you're using a lot of, well, I've got two different audio interfaces, so I'm used to having to switch around quite a lot. And I've got used to this PA VU control from Zubuntu, and so I was glad to see that in there. It's got a PDF viewer and a calculator and stuff like that, the kind of the stuff you'd expect, so it's not totally stripped down. But then you're pretty much expected to use Chromium for everything else, because they're kind of aiming this. It's always been aimed at netbooks and things that don't have necessarily a lot of storage, and it's kind of going for that Chromebook-type market, I think. And so that's why they have gone for the web apps. But I don't know. I'll get back to that, the web apps, and why I'm not a huge fan of it. Mm-hmm. But it does have some what I call cruft, really, like games. I don't really see why you bother including games if you're trying to keep it stripped down. That, you know, it's easy enough to go and get more software like that. So I would leave that out personally. I never play the games anyway, so.
Yeah, that's an interesting inclusion. I mean, because one of the things that I give the Peppermint team credit for is they knew what they were going for. They've stuck to their heritage, and you sort of spoke about that, this idea that it's supposed to be a quote-unquote cloud-friendly distribution with an eye towards integrating web apps. And early on, that they were really focused on that. Now they talk about trying to strike a balance between cloud-based applications and locally installed applications, and giving you the ability to operate in each environment, but in a sort of a coordinated interface. So they have an idea of what they want to do. And we've talked about distributions that sort of chuck the kitchen sink at you and really seem like they try and be all things to all people and they fail miserably. Peppermint isn't one of those. Peppermint has an idea of what it's trying to do and they do it well. But as you said, games it's sort of a head scratcher. I'm sure they're small in terms of how much room they take on the disk. Yeah. And you know, because they really are trying to put together, they even talk about the fact that they try and avoid bloat in what they offer. But then you have the ability to build it out from there in any way you want. The games is a little bit of a head scratcher. Part of that might be due to the fact that I don't play any of those games that, you know, these, you know, like Mahjong or chess or thing like that. I don't play those and haven't for years on a Linux box or even a Windows or, you know, Mac. So they, you know, I sort of scratch my heads when I see those on any machine. The only one I might be playing would be something like Solitaire.
Mm. And so it comes with Chromium rather than Firefox, which I'm kind of used to with most Ubuntu-based distros, which up until the last few weeks, it seemed like quite a sensible decision because a lot of people are moving away from Firefox. Now with this, I talked about it in the news, it's potentially a little bit of a questionable decision, but I think that I can see totally why they've done that. And hopefully, as you say, now all the eyes are on Chromium, that won't happen again. So it shouldn't be a problem, hopefully, going forward. But you need Chromium to use the web apps. Now, I keep using this term web apps. What I'm talking about is shortcuts or bookmarks, essentially, that reside in your menu rather than on the desktop or anywhere else. And it's got this application that is called ICE. Yeah. And it's really, really easy to put shortcuts in your menu. And the menu is the very old school menu. There's no, it's not like the Mint menu that's searchable. And that's something that I know I don't like change, but I'm starting to drift towards wanting a searchable menu like the Whisker menu. And so you've not got that by default. You've just got the old school menu. And so with this ICE application, you just put in what the URL is, which section it wants to be under, and you can put an icon for it, and then it appears in your menu. But the thing is, after that, when you click on one of these shortcuts, essentially, it opens up a new Chrome-less Chromium window. So you've got no file menu and stuff like that. It's just a kind of almost a full screen type window of Chromium running the application. And the question I have to ask myself is, why not make it more like Chrome OS? I don't know if you've ever played with a Chromebook, but it's a similar idea, but it just opens it in a new tab. So it keeps it all nice within one window rather than having loads of separate windows open, which doesn't really make sense to me.
So it sort of becomes, I think the aim is to have these appear as almost like local apps.
But so why dress it up like that? Why not just be honest about it and say that it links to websites, which is essentially what we're talking about?
Well, so I talked earlier about the fact that I'm building my mother's laptop with Peppermint. And this is the main reason I'm doing it. This is what drove me to this. We started doing the research for this episode, and I built her out a Linux Mint 13 LTS XFCE box. And then I installed Peppermint on another machine and I started playing with it more and more. And I started thinking, this is a great way for me to address how my mom actually uses a computer. And she's probably like a lot of people's moms. She does her Facebook. She does her banking. She does a couple other things, and it's all web-based. She rarely will open. I don't know if she's ever opened a word processor and, you know, tried to type something out and then print it or anything like that. But she's 99% of what she does is web-based. My mom struggles with how different browsers will be set up. If I asked her to go to Firefox from Chrome, she would struggle with it because the way it handles different tabs, and it's only slightly different to you and I, and we can figure it out pretty quick. For her, it's like it's an entirely different approach to looking at a web page. And so when I started thinking about, okay, I can use ICE and I can build these shortcuts, both, and you can have them both in the menu. When you build them, as you said, you actually choose where it goes inside your menu. So it can go inside the internet section, it can go inside the office section, you could create a new section if you want. You know, you can do these things. But once it's there, you can also right click on it and put it to the desktop. Now, one of the things that happens when you put it into the desktop is Nemo, which handles those desktop shortcuts, sees it as an untrusted link. And so when you first put it up there, it won't look right. It won't have the right icon, and it won't have it'll say Facebook.desktop. First time you click on it, Nemo will ask you, do you trust this? And you can say, yeah, Mark is trusted. And once you do that, it'll take the icon, it'll show as the icon, and it'll change to the title that you gave that ICE application. So, but you can put it on the desktop. So my idea is I talk to my mom, I take all the things that she does regularly, and I create these shortcuts for her, and I can put them both on the desktop, and I can put them down in the panel because the panel is fully customizable. So I can put launchers down there like you can do with Cinnamon or with Windows 7 or, you know, the Mac. You know, you can actually have sort of a launcher in that bottom panel. And so for me, it's gonna simplify what my mom does. She's not going to have to go into the menu. She doesn't have to, you know, go searching for stuff. But from that point of view, she doesn't use a whole lot of functionality. She's not in there going into system settings or going, you know, to all these other places that you might go inside the menu. And it seemed like a perfect use case scenario for something like Peppermint. The other point that we hadn't really brought up is, I'm putting this on a Core 2 Duo Lenovo T61. So this is a fairly old box. It's got 4 gigs of RAM. It absolutely flies on that box. It really, the goal of having a stripped down distribution, they've succeeded at that. LXDE, using LXDE is the base for the desktop environment. Great idea. They also use, we talked a little bit about some of the things that they've adopted from other distros. They use Nemo is the file manager. They like it better than the default one that comes with LXDE. So they put in Nemo. Great idea. And it all seems to move very quickly. And you know, for a Core 2 Duo box, used to be top of the line, hasn't been for years and years. It moves pretty quick, and the performance is great.
Yeah, I put it on a Core 2 Duo machine as well, so I experienced that same swiftness. I would say that compared to Lubuntu, though, and this is purely anecdotally, I haven't done any tests, it feels that tiny bit, I'm not going to say more sluggish, I'm going to put it the other way, less light. Because straight up LXDE, with no compositing at all, no effects, it feels that little bit faster. That said, this has the window transparency and various effects, and I didn't really get on with that. It doesn't make sense to me. I like it simpler. And I thought, right, let's go and have a dig through and see how I can fix that. And Peppermint Control Center is brilliant. I would say not for the likes of your mum or my mum or someone who's not particularly, you know, technically savvy, but for me, it was really easy to turn all the desktop effects off in one click, and then suddenly it is as fast as Lubuntu. But you've got that option if you've got an i3 or i5, whatever, and you put those effects on, it'll still be lightning fast, and it'll look nice if you like that sort of thing. And that control center is brilliant. There's so many sections you can do change all sorts of stuff if you want. I mean, the defaults are fairly sensibly set up in the first place, but you do have that level of customization under the hood if you want it. And again, that makes me really happy. It's the total opposite of Unity, where it's just take it or leave it. This is what you've got.
So one of the features that I actually like, and you can tell me what you think about it, is you've mentioned it before, this idea that they borrowed from other distributions, things that they saw were positive. And we talked about the kinship with Mint. They borrowed Nemo, which we talked about a little bit, but they also borrowed the software manager. So if you're not an apt or aptitude guy, and both of those are there, so if you are one of those types of people, you can use those. But the software manager, as I said, is from Mint. And although I'm not in love with Mint's software manager, and I usually am an apt guy, I'll usually go to the command line to do my installations or updates. The thing I do like that they've done is they have some of these meta packages. Did you take a look at any of these?
No, I didn't. I noticed that it was Mint Update and Software Manager and the USB tools, but no, I didn't do the meta packages. What were they then?
So you have something like, if you want an Office meta package, it installs all of LibreOffice. So if you went into Aptitude, yeah, you can do, if you went into Aptitude or you went into the Software Manager itself, you can add these things, and it's really not that hard. So the Office package isn't necessarily a great example, but it did install all of LibreOffice, all the pieces there. What a better example would be something like the photography. They have this photography meta package, and in there is GThumb and a couple other what they would consider photography type apps. So it's a way of bundling a number of different apps on a theme. They have one that's a kid's edutainment, which is a term I hate, but you can do that. They have one that is for if you want to do packaging and builds. So it brings in a bunch of different packages and installs them all at once with one click out of the software center. So, it's just, I like, Bodhi does a similar type of thing where you can click on one thing and you install a number of different packages that aren't necessarily related to each other, but are on a common theme and build your box out in a particular way, like I say, with one click. So I did like that. As I said, I'm not in love with the Mint software manager. I think it's something they need to put a little work into at some point. It's getting a little long in the tooth. It's, it's not that pretty. From that point of view, I think it's great they have that. You talked about the USB tools, USB stick formatter and USB image writer, and those are straight out of Mint. They just basically brought them right over. Things like that, I really, we talked about the sort of their ideology and how they go about building this stuff, this distribution, and I really like that idea. It's why invent the wheel if people have done a good job of it? And the integration is such that it doesn't feel like it's a bunch of disparate parts bolted onto each other. All feels like it's part of a common distribution, well executed.
Yeah, they've taken bits from here, bits from there, but yeah, put it together in a way that feels good. So yeah, I'm very impressed with that aspect of it. And there's a couple of little things that I really liked as well. For example, the right-click MD5 sum. Is that something that's in Nemo normally?
I think it is, but maybe the chat room can keep us honest on that. I think that's great. I mean, people don't use that enough. Have that right-click functionality. That just makes sense.
Yeah, if you're doing a lot of ISO downloads and a lot of testing of distros like I do, I mean, generally I'll try and use a torrent, but if there isn't a torrent available and it has to be a direct download, then that's just so much easier than trying to do it in the command line, which, yeah, granted, is not too difficult, but this just makes it that bit easier. So yeah, very impressed with just little touches like that.
Yep. Yeah. And again, I think it has that feel top to bottom that they have an idea of what they're trying to do. They've matured in building this out, and now it's a nice polished distro that runs. The fact that it's it's not just them, but LXD has come a long way from being that stripped down, lightweight desktop environment to being something that has a ton of functionality. I think I mentioned it earlier. it's easy to customize that bottom panel. So it comes with the bottom panel, but you can put that panel anywhere you want. You can create another panel. You can put launchers in that panel. You can do a number of things in terms of customization of that panel. You can make it opaque. You can have it be part of a theme. That sort of customizability is great, you know, and it's something that in the past, these lightweight desktops, this is where they would skimp. This is where you would, you know, the differentiation between them and a more heavyweight desktop would be seen in sort of your ability to customize. One thing that is interesting is by default, you get a 24-hour clock by default, and it's just the time. So like right now here in Durham, North Carolina, it's 16:34 as I look at my streaming box here. And that's what you would see down in the panel there. And you can actually change the properties of that, but it's that old archaic, you
have to actually go signs and stuff.
Yes. Percent that. And you can both the time itself and the pop-up that comes when you hover over the time, both of those are customizable. And it's not that hard to do, but you do got to go find the translation guide that tells you what those are. And yeah. You know, I had to go look that up. And my thought would be that's a place where it seems like it would be easy to write some sort of little program that would do that in the background. We would put the percent A, percent I, percent L, whatever it is, in the background while you just chose what you wanted in some sort of graphical interface. So that's an interesting piece that, you know, and sort of harkens back to the lightweight roots of these desktops. But again, the execution just it has a really nice feel to it, and it feels holistic. Versus, again, like we were saying before, like some bolted on parts. So I'm really, really happy to be able to use this as a base for this box that I'm building for my mom. And I think it's going to be, I think this way of going about it is going to be very successful.
Well, one complaint that I've got on it is the file manager access, in that there's no desktop shortcut, that it's not on the panel by default. And so the only way to access it is via the menu. And that must be because it's sort of aiming to be this cloud-based, web-based OS, you know, distro, where local files are less important. But I still want access to them. And so I tried to add a Places plugin, you know, like you have in XFCE that I'm used to. And it seemed to work, but you know, added it, you've got the menu there. Okay, there's my various directories, click on one and nothing happened. It wouldn't open them. And I don't know if that's maybe because it's Nemo and that somehow there was some conflict there. But the only way I could get to my file manager was via the menu. I think it was in accessories and, you know, it's sort of a couple of levels deep in the menu. And that is something I use all the time. So that is a bit of a negative point, but I can kind of see why they've ended up doing that.
Yeah, but even to that point, you know, this idea that, like you say, local files aren't as important when you're trying to strike that balance as Peppermint OS is between cloud-based and locally installed, locally accessed programs. I think you need to that's probably something they need to work on to simplify or to make more accessible. You know, to hit that balance versus. And that may be part of the heritage, you know, of trying to be more cloud-based and sort of now they're swinging back to having a balance. The idea that access to local files is a little buried, maybe a carryover from prior versions.
Mm. And I mean, I mentioned the menu. I really would like to see something more like the Mint menu, or as Martin forked it for the Ubuntu Mate, I think it's just called the Mate menu there. I don't know how easy it would be to implement that or possibly even just the Whisker menu. I think that would be maybe a bit easier, but it feels a bit archaic to just have the old fashioned menu and to at least not have an option to make it searchable. I'd like to see that. I think it, and you know, you want to be able to press the Windows key, super key, whatever, and start typing and get your applications that way. I think I'd like to see that. And it seems strange for me to be saying this because I was always going on about the hierarchical menus and that being the sensible way of doing things. But I think I've finally come around to more modern menus is the bottom line. So that makes it feel a little bit old for my taste.
Yeah, and that may be very well may be a result of the LXD desktop environment. And that may be the price that you're paying is that type of menu.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. It seems like everywhere you go, it's press a key, type a few letters in, and then you know, the Mac certainly works that way. You know, Windows 7 has been that way, you know, and most desktop environments, you've got that feature now.
Yeah. Even XFCE's got the whisker menu now. So yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
But I mean, I'm still very impressed with it. And I've got a new toy that I didn't talk too much about, which I shouldn't drop in at the end of this, but it's essentially a NUC type device. It's made by Gigabyte. And it's literally 4 inches by 4 inches by maybe 1.5 inches or 2 inches tall. But it also has got a Pico projector inside it. I finally got my dream of having a projector, and I was watching Jaws last night, and I measured the area, and it was, I think 79 inches on my wall.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really cool. But what's running on that? Peppermint at the moment. That's how I'm impressed I am with it, that I think I'm probably going to stick with it for the time being on there.
Very cool. Yeah. And from my point of view, I think that, as I've said, I think this is the right distro to put on a computer that I'm then going to put in the mail to my mom and have to support going forward. I think it's the right distro because I think I'll be able to support it without too much effort. And I think it's going to work for her needs in the fashion that I customize it, which they make very easy. So I think it's going to be at least in an environment that I'm involved in for a while now. So, you know, to that end, I would say kudos to the Peppermint team. I think they are on the right track. And I really enjoyed taking a look at this. I know you guys looked at Fedora 22 or whatever last time. And,
yeah.
You know, Fedora has been kind of a headache to look at. And it's typically something that gets wiped off of machines as soon as we're done with our episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for me, Ubuntu has been that way. The Unity versions, they're gone within a half an hour of us concluding taping the episode.
Yeah.
This is one that's going to stick around. I really like what they're doing. And I definitely give kudos to the team and wish them continued success.
Yep.
All right. So that is going to do it for our look at Peppermint OS 6. We're going to move into just a little bit of feedback. So we didn't get a ton of feedback over the last week or so, but Joe, I'm going to ask you to kick us off with the first one.
Okay. So the first one is from iCarter1391, who is Isaac Carter, who is the next bit of feedback as well, because he won't leave us alone.
Yeah, who is this guy? It's like a stalker.
I know, yeah. He even shows up on my own personal show. Anyway, he says, awesome show, guys, as always. I mentioned in the live chat that there were more screensavers for Cinnamon 2.6 beyond just the Stars one. Seems that I was wrong. There were previously other screensavers such as Tower of Hanoi 1, but I found out that they were removed due to memory and power issues. Currently, there's no timetable set for their return. Hopefully, they'll reappear on the next version of Cinnamon or another future release. So, yeah, we talked about that as adding screensavers to Cinnamon. Well, right now there is a screensaver. I haven't actually checked that in the release candidates, but release candidate of 17.2. But when I tried out the new version of Cinnamon, there was only one screensaver, I'm afraid. So one's better than none, but you know, here's hoping for some more.
Did you look at all for one in Peppermint? I did not. I looked quickly and did not see one.
I never use screensavers. I generally set up my machines so that if it's a desktop, I turn the monitor off manually. If it's a laptop, I set it so that I just close the lid and that turns the screen off. So yeah. Screensavers, I've had nothing but troubles with screensavers coming on when they shouldn't be with XFCE. So no, that's not something I didn't actually experience it at all. So maybe they're on my wavelength there, that in this day and age of LCD screens and LED screens, they're less important than the old CRT days.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. For me, it was more a case of when I built out the Peppermint box, I walked away leaving the laptop open, came back a while later, and it was still displaying the screen. And of course, it was plugged in, so it was on AC power. And I think the default power management is that it never shuts off when it's on AC power. So rather than actually utilize a screensaver, I just set it, you know, you can set it 5, 10, 30, 15, 30 minutes that it'll power down the screen or power down the box entirely and go into a suspend mode. And so, yeah, I'm not sure that a screensaver is needed in that case because, you know, you just, like you say, after 30 minutes, you just have it power down or to shut the screen down after 10 minutes of no use versus have it go into a screensaver. So that's probably the way I'll approach that. You know, just thinking of how I want it for my mom, you know, when she wasn't using it, that it would, you know, like I say, that it would power down or at least shut the screen off after 30 minutes or something.
Yeah.
All right. So we got an email from Isaac Carter as well, and wanted to go ahead and take time to read this because this is great. Isaac says, just wanted to say thanks for taking the time to do the podcast. It is always much appreciated. Recently, I've been working on acquiring old computers and bringing them back to life by installing Linux Mint on them, with the goal in mind of giving them to families in need. The past couple of weeks, I contacted a church in one of the rougher areas of DC, and I'm assuming that's Washington, DC, that might know of a family that could use a computer. I would like to happily announce that I was able to make a family's life a little better. I walked the family through the ins and outs of using Mint and also got the church to allow me to teach a Linux class to families that might want to learn more about Linux or about Mint computers. I should have 4 more laptops by this time next week that I will install Mint on and will also hand out to more families in need. I would like to say thanks to Ken Starks for inspiring me to do this. I reached out to Ken about what I should do or things that I should think about when doing this kind of work, and also about the paperwork concerning becoming a charity / nonprofit. Since then, we have been emailing back and forth, and he has been a great help and mentor. I will be presenting at the DC Lug pretty soon about the work I'm doing, and hopefully we'll recruit some more volunteers. If you live in or around the DC area and would like to help or just want to help, please reach out to me. And he gives his email, which is icarter1391@gmail.com. Thanks again, guys, for helping me get the word out. And both Rob and I had an opportunity to just write back to Isaac, because this is one of the things that, you know, we've talked about Ken Starks many times. He's down in the Austin area and he does Regaloo, which is probably a much, much larger operation than Isaac's been able to enter into at this point. But he's been at it for a while and has given away quite a few computers. And, you know, it's funny because just prior to getting this email, I was thinking, I don't know why, but I was thinking about the digital divide and this idea that we take for granted. You know, we talked earlier about being plugged into the, you know, information via, you know, having internet or having a cell signal. But the thought that there are a lot of people out there who don't have this same access to, you know, ready access to the internet, to things like Wikipedia, to the news sources that you get on there, to the information that comes from the internet, to computing in general, that they can't afford it, that they don't have it. They don't have access to it in any way, shape, or form. And the idea that there's folks like Isaac, like Ken Starks, who are out there trying to address that situation. I can't stress how important I think this is, and the work that Isaac is doing, that Ken Starks is doing, that how important it is that those of us who have been able to benefit to the degree that we have, that we try and address this in some way, shape, or form, either through donating time, donating equipment, donating money to those organizations that are doing this, so that we can address this digital divide and that everybody gets the opportunities that I know I take for granted on a daily basis. So I wanted to say thank you very much to Isaac and what he's doing, and I'm going to figure out how I can help support what he's doing, and again think about what Ken's doing and how I can support that work. But Isaac, I think you're out in the chat room. I just want to say thank you very much for this. This is awesome what you're doing, and let us know what we can do to support you and make this expansion of this idea a reality for you.
Yeah, and as I wrote back to Isaac when he told me about this before he wrote to the show, I said to him, just let's hope they don't sell the computers and buy meth, eh? No, but seriously, it's obviously a good thing. I think the church is probably a good place to start as well.
Yeah. And, you know, it has to be one of those things that you put out there. And what happens after the fact, outside of your ability to support it, you just, you're putting that out to the universe. You can't make those decisions for people. And, you know, I think just doing stuff like this, you know, and maybe the person who buys it for that meth is somebody who needs to get over the digital divide as well. Who knows? You know, whatever the case may be, this is something that needs to be addressed, and people like Isaac and Ken doing it is, you know, my hats are off to them.
Yeah. Okay, well, another Ken on Google Plus, Ken Harbit, said, just listen to 226. I was trying Fedora 22 while listening. It takes twice as long to install as Mint 17.2 on a Lenovo T520 with 4 gigs of RAM. I tried the software install icon, not much there yet. I found GNU Merrick, but not AbbeyWord. In fact, there wasn't anything for word processing. My mind said WTF, and I reinstalled Mint 17.2. It might be an RC, but it's really good and seems to be faster than 17.1, both coming up and loading applications. Great podcast. So, yeah, Fedora is a bit of a terrible experience if you're used to something as easy as Mint. It's just not aimed at the same type of users, I don't think.
Well, we also heard from Morton, who writes the show a fair amount, and he wrote on Google Plus that he was listening to the Fedora episode as well. And as for how it looks, Fedora and the spins are very default in settings, so GNOME is GNOME, and XFCE and LXD versions look like Windows 95. If you want to compare to Mint, you should look at Corora. DNF has a new version of YumX called YumX DNX, which is nice. I agree the installer is hopeless, but the previous installer was quite good. If you have yet to understand why I have yet to understand why they built a new one, and we've been asking that question for a number of releases. Let's not make ubiquity ubiquitous, please. I would rather port the new Manjaro installer, if anything. So, I mean, we were talking earlier about ubiquity and how it's pretty good and it's pretty simple. But I can see Morton's point, and we don't necessarily, I mean, open source is about choice. I choose not to use the new Fedora installer because it's horrible. But, you know, I was hoping by this point that they would work some of the kinks out. We did an in-depth review of that installer. Oh, it's probably a year ago, maybe even longer, and ripped it to shreds because it was absolutely horrible. And it sounds like it's still there. Still
horrible. Yeah, it hasn't improved much, if at all. It's just, if you don't know about partitioning and how, you know, setting up root accounts, setting up user accounts, it's aimed at people who know what they're doing is the bottom line. And, you know.
Yeah. Have you looked at Corora before?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. I can't remember if we took a look at this a long, long time ago. It would be worth checking into again just to see how it compares to Mint. So anyways, that is it for our feedback. We do have a website and a tip for you. Our website, yeah, we're lazy. It's peppermintos.com. Go check it out. We like the website. The website's full of information. They've got a blog up there. They talk about the different releases. The kernel developer is actually blogging up there, which is great. He talks about the Peppermint OS 6 and some of the thought behind it. So definitely worth taking a look at. And again, you can download Peppermint OS 6, which will fit on a CD, as we mentioned before. So it's a quicker download than a lot of other ones. And our tip is one that I came across that I thought might be interesting for folks. It's actually, we're going to send you to an article out on howtoforge.com, which is a tutorial on how to benchmark your GPU on Linux. So Linux in general, I found, well, it seems like most benchmarks that I've run across in the past have been written for Windows boxes. And you see an absolute ton of benchmarking applications and utilities that you can use on those. But I think Phoronix has done a lot of work in this space towards benchmarking on Linux. And so I thought this was interesting. And they actually discuss three different applications that you can install, very likely are going to be out there on your in your repositories. They use apt-get to install them. So they're certainly in the Ubuntu repositories, and that's GLX Gears, which is one, and then GL Mark II, and then finally the Unigen benchmark products. And so we'll have the link in the show notes. You can do that. You can go out and if you're somebody who has built your own machine or have some whoop-de-doo graphics card in your box, which I did it, well, not in the streaming box, but my other machine does. So, or it did at one point. Now it's getting a couple of years old. So it's, you know, basically obsolete as far as graphics go. But I'm going to be doing these over the next week or so, and I'll let you know what the results are next time we meet. So go ahead and follow that link if you're somebody who's interested in benchmarking your GPU.
Yeah.
All right, a few podcast announcements, same ones we've been talking about before. We have Faisal 16, F-I-S-L 16, in Porto Alegre, Brazil. That's coming up July 8th through the 11th. We have LinuxCon coming up in August 17th through 19th in Seattle. The Texas Linux Fest is August 21st and 22nd in San Marcos. Go there, meet Rob. They're doing a call for papers right now. And then we have Ohio Linux Fest, October 2nd and 3rd in Columbus, Ohio, which is always a big one. And they're doing a call for presentations right now. And then looks like this one's fairly new, is that we're going to see yet another OgCamp. So tell us a little bit about this, because I bet you put this in.
I did put this in, and I don't know much about it at all, apart from that it is October the 30th to November the 1st, so Halloween weekend.
Oh, my goodness.
In Liverpool, at the same place as it was last time, last couple of times in Liverpool, John Moores University. And I only know this because Dan Lynch, formerly of Linux Outlaws, posted about it on Twitter. If you go to ogcamp.org, it's still advertising the last one from last year. So hopefully it'll get updated soon. But yeah, it's definitely happening. And so I will be going along with Paddy and Jesse from Linux Luddites. Cha-ching, haven't got a plug-in yet for that.
Yeah, wow.
Well, I almost went a whole show there.
Yes.
But I have discovered that hotels are rather expensive that weekend, and I phoned up one of the hotels and spoke to a delightful woman who told me that that weekend is always busy in Liverpool. They're really quite big on Halloween, so it's going to be the city. If you imagine, Halloween actually falls on Saturday, so it's going to be big parties going on in the city centre, and so hotel rooms are going to be hard to come by potentially, and potentially a little bit more than last time. So you want to get on it early. That I almost booked it today, but I want to be 100% double sure about what the other guys are doing before I actually book anything. But yeah, it's I haven't even said what OgCamp's about. It's the biggest open source and free culture event in the UK. And it's an unconference. Well, it's kind of almost an unconference because they have scheduled talks usually, as well as unconference talks where anyone can pitch up on the day, say what they want to talk about, and then people vote on it. And I have been to, I think, three of the last four, and it's always been a great time. Everyone's been really cool, and there's been loads of drinks and parties and everything. So yeah, if you're in the UK, definitely come along.
And this is great because there was some concern about the future of OgCamp with the demise of Linux Outlaws. They usually work on this with the Ubuntu, UK Ubuntu podcast folks, with that being reincarnated. It's great to see that this is continuing on, and it sounds like it's going to be a crazy time. So, yeah, like you say, book early or figure out where you can book in the surrounding areas and take the train in or whatever, and make your plans for Halloween this year.
You should try and be here, try and wangle it with work, Scott. And
I think I'm going to end up, I was talking with my boss about it, and it looks like maybe September. So I don't think I'm going to be able to make it for that. But
okay, well, as soon as you got the dates for it, let me know if you're going to be around London again, and we'll have another in the pub
meetup. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so let's do the podcast and acknowledgements. We want to acknowledge Kay Wisher for the PieCaster. It's my understanding it's now running Arch. So the PieCaster is a Raspberry Pi that streams each episode. And I think I saw that earlier. I think Kay Wisher was in the chat room and mentioned that is running Arch now. So there it is. And I also noticed that Kay Wisher posted something on Google Plus where they were getting incredible amounts of rain. So we appreciate, I was going to reach out to you to make sure you were up and running, but then I forgot. And sure enough, you were when I tried to connect. I was able to connect. So that's great. And we appreciate all the work that Kay Wisher does in keeping that podcast running. Also want to acknowledge John Neustetter for the Mumble server that we use to communicate. And finally, the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro we love to talk about. So that is going to do it for episode 227. We appreciate everybody in the chat, everybody who stuck with us through a little bit of technical difficulties there, and all of you who download and listen to Mintcast. Thanks for listening.
See you later.
This has been another episode of Mintcast. The show notes for this episode are at www.mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org or leave voicemail at +1-832-514-2278. That's 832-514-CAST. You can find more information on Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter at Mintcast and at Linux_Mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco and Oscar for the podcast music, and thanks for listening to this episode of Mintcast.